So let's get started. This workshop is called Overcoming Health Anxiety. If you don't have health anxiety, it's okay. You will still get something out of this workshop. Because really it applies to like all forms of anxiety. Anxiety just likes to land on different things, and sometimes it lands on your relationship, and sometimes it lands on money, sometimes it lands on social things, and sometimes it lands on your health, and sometimes it lands on, whatever. So can everyone see my second screen? Are we good to go? Amazing. All right, welcome. With every workshop, I'm going to tell you more about myself. So here's what I'm going to tell you tonight. I'm going to tell you my favorite movies and TV shows. You might want to screenshot this or write them down in case you've never seen any of them because they are amazing. They're amazing. They're the best movies ever. Captain Fantastic is my number one. Anybody ever seen Captain Fantastic? Give me a yes or a no. No. Oh, you guys have to watch Captain Professor Marston and the Wonder Woman. Have you ever seen that one? Oh my gosh. Please tell me you've seen the first Avatar. Like everyone's seen the first Avatar, right? Okay, amazing. Christine has seen the first Avatar. Marissa has seen the first Avatar. I don't know. Christine, have you seen it? No? What? Girl, have you been hiding under a rock? Anybody not seen the Lonesome Dove miniseries? It came on in like the late 80s. You haven't seen it either, Christine? Sharon, y'all need to watch the Lonesome Dove miniseries. It is Robert Duvall's best role. Like he was born to play the role that he plays in this miniseries. It's so good. And then my favorite TV shows are The Office, Outlander, Great British Baking Show. And I can't believe I could add this, but I could actually add this now. I was so against watching it for so long, but we watched it recently. We binged the whole thing, and I was like, oh my God, why did it take us so long to watch this? I love Bridgerton. I love Bridgerton. It's so hot, you guys. I love Bridgerton. And we've recently started watching true crime stuff. Like, I never thought I would be into that because I really hate anything like suspenseful or mystery or anything like that. But we just choose them very carefully, and then I'm okay. I don't like to watch like nervous system activating TV. So, as always, I'm not a healthcare provider, so please take what you learn here and be responsible with it, and definitely discuss anything with your healthcare providers if you have questions. My presentation is protected by copyright laws. Please don't steal my shit. If you do want to take screenshots and tag me or whatever on social media, I'm totally grateful for you to do that. And this is our third workshop. If you guys can believe, we're after tonight, we're halfway through, which is crazy. So tonight's our third workshop in the series, and our group coaching call is next week. It's on Monday. Please note that it's on Monday, not Tuesday. All of our calls, except for this one, are on Tuesday, but this one is on Monday because I'm flying to Washington on Tuesday. So I will be on a plane at the time that we're supposed to be having a group call. And then our next workshop is called Expand. It's about widening your window of tolerance. It is on Wednesday, June 19th at 5 p.m. Central. The coaching call is the following Tuesday, the 25th at 10 a.m., the normal time. And this workshop is about increasing the capacity of your nervous system to hold more and not just more stress, but also more expansion, more pleasure, more joy. Will learn how to begin widening your window of tolerance through conscious choice, intentional stressors, titration, and safety. So that is what next one is about. It's amazing, if I do say so myself. All right, let's talk about health anxiety in a symptom phobic culture. Raise your hand if you would say you have health anxiety. Yes, okay. You can use the little hand raiser button if you need to. Okay, cool. A few of you, amazing. I mean, not amazing. It's not amazing to have health anxiety, but hopefully you get what I'm saying. Okay, several of you do. Amazing. It just took you a minute to find the button to raise your hand. I was like, really? Only three people here are into this? Oh my gosh. But no, it's way more. It's like at least half of you. All right, so we're going to talk about it. Health anxiety is also called illness anxiety disorder. It used to be called hypochondria. Oh, we have Nicole connecting. So, hey, Nicole, I just started, girl. Here we're talking about health anxiety in a symptom phobic culture. So you literally just missed the first couple slides. So in the DSM, it's illness anxiety disorder. It used to be called hypochondria. So if you've ever been called a hypochondriac or have called yourself a hypochondriac, or you know someone who's a hypochondriac is just someone who has health anxiety. So illness anxiety disorder, according to the DSM, is characterized by an obsession with the idea of having a serious but undiagnosed medical condition and worry that minor symptoms indicate something serious. So I'm going to show you through this workshop that health anxiety is not a disorder, as the DSM would like for us to believe. It is a very natural but unconscious reaction to nervous system dysregulation and complex PTSD. Health anxiety is just one way that complex PTSD manifests. All other forms of anxiety are also manifestations of complex PTSD, or PTSD if you have PTSD, but the focus of this series is mostly on complex PTSD. But all forms of anxiety is not the problem. Anxiety is a symptom of the problem. So I even argue that anxiety isn't a diagnosis, that it is a symptom of the diagnosis, which is nervous system dysregulation, or complex PTSD. So isn't it interesting in our symptom phobic society that the focus on and fear of symptoms and sensations is pathologized, diagnosed, and treated as a mental illness or disorder, but our conventional sick care system, wellness culture, and society as a whole is obsessed with symptoms? So how many of you joined Feel Without Fear because of symptoms? Just curious if anyone wants to be a few. Okay, cool. Thanks for your honesty. So isn't it interesting that in all of our systems, we're very focused on symptoms, even in the natural healthcare system, there's all this focus on symptoms, but the focus on symptoms is pathologized as well. So it's focus on your symptoms because you don't need to have symptoms, because if you have symptoms, it means you're sick. But if you're worried about those symptoms, then you have a mental illness. Isn't that just crazy making? I just think that's so, so crazy. So I strongly believe that most health anxiety is perpetuated by our symptom-focused culture, especially in wellness culture. It seems that the more chronic and mysterious the issues, the better. Not the better for your health, but that seems to fuel health anxiety a lot. The more mysterious your symptoms are, the more random or disconnected they seem to be, seems to kind of fuel that. And it pretty much guarantees that you're going to get on that hamster wheel of wellness, the more chronic and mysterious your symptoms are. And in your efforts to find and fix what's wrong, you're guaranteed to spend your time and money on practitioners, supplements, and health gadgets. If you don't have health anxiety, you'll get on the hamster wheel of trying to fix your relationship. You'll get on a hamster wheel of worrying about money or of worrying about social things. And then you're jumping from, therapist to book to Instagram account to whatever, also trying to fix that about yourself. Or if folks aren't interested in natural approaches, then we're guaranteed to spend our time and money on doctor's appointments and labs and imaging and pharmaceuticals. So either way, having health anxiety and living in this culture that's very focused on symptoms to the point that it pathologizes worrying about symptoms, it just basically guaranteed that you're going to stay in the system, in the loop, going in circles, chasing symptoms, which is beneficial to the system, but it is not beneficial to you because the system makes money off of you being concerned about your health or your relationship or your finances or your whatever, so that you get on that hamster wheel to start spinning out, the money and the time and the energy, putting your attention into that. Health anxiety only benefits corporations and companies that promise relief for healing in exchange for money. And if you don't get better, then you're told to find something else, which requires more time and money. Although it's outside the scope of this workshop to discuss capitalism, please don't discount the influence that capitalism plays in our healthcare industry. It is an industry. It is focused on turning a profit off of you being anxious about your own body in a system that told you to focus on your symptoms. Okay, so it's here, worry about your symptoms. Now here, take our pills and come to our appointments and our offices that promise to help you or fix you or cure you or whatever. And maybe it works, but maybe it doesn't, right? It's just, I don't know. I just feel that needs to be called out. So let's talk about symptom obsession, just to prove to you how obsessed we are with symptoms. When you go to the doctor, you have to rate your symptoms and your pain on a scale of 1 to 10, right? So that causes you to have to focus on your symptom to the point that you can give it a number ranking on a scale. You keep journals or logs of symptoms and potential associations with those symptoms, like foods or substances or allergens or environmental factors or whatever. There's an emphasis on pharmaceuticals to reduce or stop symptoms without addressing the root cause. There's an emphasis in wellness culture to fix symptoms with supplements and restrictive diets. So the more symptoms you can check off the checklist, the more likely you are to be like, oh, look at this shiny healing diet that I've never tried before that's promising to heal all the things I've checked off on this box. Maybe I'll try that. And in either case, symptoms are bad and they need to be suppressed, fixed, controlled, and gotten rid of. And especially in the like mainstream conventional healthcare system, they're really not in the business of addressing root causes. They're very, very much in the business of symptom suppression and symptom management. Because if they address your root cause and heal you, then you won't be a patient who spends money anymore. but if they can keep you like needing things to manage and suppress, then you're always going to be a returning customer, right? So, and we also can't forget to mention that COVID forced people to be hypervigilant about their own symptoms as well as other symptoms. So I can't tell you how many people I've met in the last 4 years who like didn't give a lick about their health at all, like were not concerned about symptoms or colds or flus or whatever before. But then COVID like flipped that switch on in their brains and bodies. And now they're like extra hypervigilant about, you know, sniffles or coughing or whatever. Before 2020, we were not always so hypervigilant about runny noses and sneezing and sore throats. And I'm not saying COVID isn't real, right? Like, that's not what I'm saying. Like, of course people died from that, but you know, now they're saying to treat it like a common cold or a flu, which is how a lot of us were treating it whenever it was happening. And then many people who didn't have health anxiety prior to COVID have health anxiety now. So with all of the controlling, the micromanaging, the fixing, the suppressing, and the medicating of symptoms, is it any wonder why our bodies are screaming at us? Like, of course we're anxious, right? So like, there's nothing wrong with you if you're anxious about your body and the weird things that your body might be doing or symptoms that you might be having that you cannot discern a root cause for or whatever. Like, there's nothing wrong with you. Of course you're anxious about it because you've been told to focus on it and you've been told to avoid things that would cause that symptom and you've been given medications and supplements to try to control the symptom. Like, of course you're anxious about it, right? It makes sense. So of course, every new feeling or sound from your body feels threatening. This definitely used to be a thing for me. Like any new thing that my body did, even if it was something extremely mild and completely like innocent and innocuous, like I registered it as like, oh my God, I have cancer. Or like, oh my God, I have some big problem and I'm going to need surgery or something like that. Also with health anxiety, resurgences of old symptoms trigger fear that the thing is back. Like whatever you've worked so hard to get rid of, whenever you have a symptom that mimics that or that indicates to you that that thing is back, it triggers you. And then you want to avoid feeling what's happening in your body because it's scary. Your body has become a scary place to be. But health anxiety isn't about symptoms. Like so many people with health anxiety really do believe if I could just figure out what's causing the symptom and get rid of it, then I wouldn't have health anxiety anymore. And that's not true. You had anxiety before it manifested as health anxiety. It was just probably manifesting as something else, like general anxiety or social anxiety or relationship anxiety. So like I said, people often believe that if their symptoms go away, then their health anxiety will go away. But this is false. The symptoms are not the cause of health anxiety. Until you address the root cause of health anxiety, which is nervous system dysregulation caused by complex PTSD, you will continue to experience anxiety. If not about your health, it will transfer to something else. I like to think of anxiety as like a bumblebee that's just like going from flower to flower to flower. And like, it like goes to the health flower and it like spends some time there for a bit. And then it jumps to the money flower and it spends some time there. And then it jumps to the, you know, business flower and it spends some time there. or your romantic relationship or whatever, like anxiety just likes to do that. It finds things to be anxious about. And sometimes those things are really obvious and sometimes they're not. Is anyone noticing resistance in your body at this point? I just want to check in and see if everyone's feeling comfortable and safe, or if there's some resistance, any little bit, maybe, maybe not. Okay. Just notice that, right? Just be present with it if you feel that. Do you have any voices in your head that are saying that your symptoms are not the cause of your health anxiety? Anybody have objections to that? If you're like, but they are, if I could just get rid of them, if I just didn't feel them anymore, I wouldn't have this dumb anxiety. Maybe a little bit. Okay. So let's talk about the voice in our heads. With health anxiety, the fear usually does not come from the actual symptom or sensation itself. The fear actually comes from the meaning that the voice in your head is making about the symptom or the sensation, or the gut-wrenching feeling of uncertainty about what's happening in your body. So like for people who don't experience health anxiety, they don't have a voice in their head that's making meaning about these different sensations or symptoms that they have. So they're not anxious about it. Or they aren't feeling the like awful feeling of uncertainty about whatever's going to happen. So they're not anxious about it. So if you came here tonight and you raised your hand and said that you have health anxiety, tell me in the chat. Let me open the chat really quick. Tell me in the chat what your voice in your head says about your symptoms and sensations. Or even if you don't have health anxiety, but you really don't like the sensations in your body sometimes, and the voice in your head likes to make meaning about those. I don't know what this is. I'm going to die. But my body is failing me. It's sick. Yeah. Anybody else? Do you know how common those are? Health, the lump is cancer. With work, the uncertainty will kill me. That things are taking a turn for the worse, that something is going on with my brain. Okay. Yep. Do you know how common this is? Like, you guys are like literally repeating everything that other cohorts have said to this question. My voice is saying that my body is the problem and I have to conquer my body to get rid of my symptoms. Yeah. Yeah. That's intense. Thank you all for sharing. Oh, I saw Nicole share something and then I clicked off of it. Where's my chat? My persistent fatigue is thyroid cancer. Interesting. Yeah. I had pelvic floor dysfunction for 5 months. And I thought by the time I got to the urologist office, before I knew it was pelvic, or before I knew it was, yeah, pelvic floor dysfunction, I was like, I have bladder cancer. Like, I just know it. Like, I have bladder cancer. And sure enough, it was not that. But yeah, the worst case scenario is where the health anxiety brain likes to jump, or where the anxiety brain likes to jump. Okay, so here are some of the things that people have answered in the past that you guys have just added to. What if you never figured it out? What if this goes on and on and I get worse, or maybe I like lose ability, right? I lose mobility. I lose my ability to be in social places, ability to walk, something like that. What if I can't afford to fix this? What if this means I'm getting an autoimmune illness / cancer / insert other catastrophic condition? What if I can't take care of myself? Why won't my body just do what I need or want it to do? I can't live my life until this thing is gone, or until it's fixed, or until it's better. Or a lot of like, don't complain, people will think you're a hypochondriac. So like, then you end up like holding it all inside because you don't want to burden other people, or you don't want people to be like, oh, it's no big deal, you're just being a hypochondriac or whatever. So if this voice is in your head, which is a part of you, wasn't a fearful, critical, or shaming voice, if it wasn't telling you you had cancer, if it wasn't telling you that your body's broken and you need to conquer it, if it wasn't saying that, if it was a truly integrated part of your whole self, here's what your self would say. Even though this feeling or sensation or symptom is really scary. I trust myself to feel it and seek help if and when necessary. Even without certainty, I trust myself to feel this and meet my needs. It serves no purpose to speculate and catastrophize about this. I choose to focus on my love and safety instead. My body is doing exactly what it needs to do, even if I don't understand what's happening. My body is a miracle. I choose to live my life to the fullest, to do what I'm capable of doing, even if this symptom is still present. Do you notice that there's like space around those versus earlier where there was no space around anything? There's no space on what if I never figure this out, right? There's no space around what if I can't afford to fix it? Like there's no space around that. There's space here. We're creating spaciousness from the voice in the head and spaciousness from the feeling. The fearful voice in your head is a master storyteller, as I'm sure many of you have figured out by now. It will take the sensations in your body and then weave all kinds of stories and tall tales about them, such as I am tired equals, oh my God, I have thyroid cancer. It will convince you that you are dying, that you are on the road to disability, or that you're going to lose all joy in your life. It will tell you that you need to take drastic steps to control and fix the sensations. And it believes that sensations means there's always something wrong. So it's a very good storyteller. And we're pretty good at believing it, especially when we're not in awareness that it's a voice in our head telling a story. When we don't have awareness of the voice in our head, we will live in this like fear and reactivity. And again, if you don't have health anxiety, you will do the same thing. If you have relationship anxiety, the voice in your head will say things about your relationship. Like if we don't have anything in common, then that means we're not compatible. And that means we shouldn't be together. Or like, because we had this huge fight and it's a thing we've fought about before, we're not figuring this out. We're going in circles. It must mean we need to break up. Or because my partner, you know, doesn't initiate communication and I'm always the one initiating, like I can't live in this dynamic. We must need to break up, or they're not the one for me, or whatever. Again, you're living in fear and reactivity because you're not aware of the meaning that the voice in your head is telling you about whatever it is that you're experiencing. So people with health anxiety feel so triggered by what's happening in their bodies and their lack of control that they're constantly looking for certainty. This goes with any kind of anxiety, looking for certainty. So with people with health anxiety, they frequently check in with their bodies and symptoms. So like when I used to have health anxiety, I would like, if I would went a period of time where I wasn't having a symptom or a weird sensation, I would like often pause what I'm doing and like check in and be like, okay, it's still gone. Like, okay, it's still gone. And then if it was back, I was like, oh, it's back. I better get on Google and like start Googling what it means. And any Googlers in here who like to go down the Google rabbit holes with your health anxiety? Nice. Thank you for your honesty. Yeah. Excessive Googling. They'll make multiple doctor's appointments, like going from practitioner to practitioner, because surely the first one doesn't have the answers. They don't know what's going on with me. They're an idiot, whatever. I'm going to go to a different one. They're hypervigilant about new symptoms or recurrence of old symptoms. They like to micromanage themselves, or they like to micromanage their kids' health. I did that a lot. A lot of my perfectionism around food and diet was because I was afraid that my kids were going to get sick and have like all kinds of things wrong with them. And so if I was perfect with their food and their health, then they wouldn't get sick. People on health anxiety like to get on the hamster wheel of wellness. There's almost always a sense of urgency about whatever they're experiencing in their body. It's like that symptom in that moment is an emergency. And then they like to go on Facebook support groups for mystery illnesses. That's also something that I did, is like, you know, you find your illness or your symptom or your syndrome or whatever on Facebook. And then there's like support groups that you can go on, and people are all there kind of commiserating about whatever this thing is, this condition or whatever. I did that for a condition that I had called pelvic congestion syndrome. And whew, let me tell you, it was not a supportive thing for me to do. It actually created way more anxiety. It did not help alleviate the anxiety at all. So picture a 5 or 6 year old kid who feels funny sensations in their body and doesn't know what's going on. right? Just imagine, you could picture yourself as that child. You could picture your own child if you have kids. You could picture a niece or a nephew or somebody like that. But when that child is feeling funny sensations in their body and they don't know what's going on, they don't really have that voice in their head developed yet. Like that ego part of them hasn't developed. So they're not making meaning about it and worrying about what it might mean for them. They don't have the consciousness or even the understanding to know what there is to be worried about. All they want is a caring parent or some other trusted adult to reassure them, to let them know they're okay, that they're taken care of, and that they're safe. That's really all they want. Now imagine that child is you as an adult. Now, you just have that little kid in you who's looking for someone to reassure you, let you know that you're okay, that you're taken care of, and that you're safe. And even if you don't have health anxiety, if you have relationship anxiety, that's all you're looking for in your relationship. You just want them to reassure you that they're not going to leave you, to let you know that you're okay, that you're taken care of, and that you're safe. You want the same thing if you have financial anxiety, right? You just want reassurance that everything's going to be okay with your money, that you're going to be okay, that you're financially taken care of, and that you're safe. In social situations, if you have social anxiety, you want someone to reassure you like, hey, everything's okay. you're taken care of and you're safe in this situation. That's literally all people want with anxiety. So close your eyes if you haven't already. Just close your eyes and let's do just like a little visual image for a second. Picture yourself as a child, maybe 4, 5, 6 years old, and you have some sort of symptom or weird thing going on in your body. And you as a child have this like smartphone in your hand, because kids have smartphones nowadays, and you're Googling to find answers for yourself because there's no parent there to like care for you and give you the reassurance that you want or that you need. You as a little child are so scared of your body that you're always checking in with yourself. You're making doctor's appointments for yourself to figure out what's going on. You're trying to micromanage your body with this sense of doom and urgency. Something catastrophic is happening. You just know it, but you don't know what it is. Picture that little version of yourself joining Facebook support groups and following like multiple Instagram accounts because they're so desperate for help and they're just seeking certainty. Like, just tell me I'm going to be okay. Just tell me I'm going to be okay. Just tell me I'm going to be okay. Again, if you don't have health anxiety, you can do it with like relationship, right? Little kid Googling about how to know if someone's the right one for me, how to know when I'm supposed to leave my relationship, following Instagram accounts, joining Facebook groups, trying to figure out because they feel so uncertain. Okay, that's really sad, isn't it? What do you feel for that little kid inside of you? You can let me know in the chat if you had any feelings come up. If you were able to connect with that little child part of you, like what did you feel for them? Or if you had to picture your own child doing that. Sometimes it's hard for people to picture themselves, but they can picture their own kid. Yeah, it's really sad, Courtney. So sad for a kid to just feel like, I can imagine that they would feel like really lonely. Yeah, so overwhelming. Yeah, yeah, great, Jennifer, helpless. Yeah, can you imagine? If you have health anxiety, you can't imagine. Your little inner child has probably felt, yeah, it's too much to handle. Your little inner child feels helpless, overwhelmed, super sad. Your heart is breaking for her. You want to give her a hug. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, guess what? That's what we're dealing with inside of ourselves when we have these little anxious parts, right? They're sad. They feel helpless. They're overwhelmed. They really are. They're just a part of us. So now let's talk about health anxiety and complex PTSD. This is going to blow your freaking mind, okay? Like, it blew my mind when I wrote it even, so it's going to blow your mind. So as we talked about in our first workshop, complex PTSD, usually but not always, forms in childhood. It's kind of the water that we're swimming in. It's like, especially for those of us who don't have PTSD on top, like I have both. I have PTSD diagnosed, and then I have complex PTSD, which can't be diagnosed because it's not in the DSM, so it's not real. I'm using air quotes very liberally there. Okay. But I have PTSD too, but my like core wounding of my life does not come from a one-time traumatic event, which is the case with PTSD. my wounding of my life was the environment I was living in at home and all of the dysfunction that was happening around me. So even if I had never been like physically abused, which I was, even if I had never been verbally abused, which I was, even if those big things hadn't happened, even if I didn't have adverse childhood experiences, like my parents being divorced, having mentally ill parents, having substance use in the home, like things like that, which I did, all of those things, even if I didn't have those things, the water I was swimming in at home, just the environment of my home was this very emotionally volatile, unstable, dysfunctional, chaotic environment. Okay. So I'm sure many of you may have had similar experiences. As children in those types of environments, we did not have the ability cognitively or developmentally to understand that our caregivers' inability to attune to our needs and co-regulate with us wasn't our fault. There's no way we could have understood that. So that forms deep core beliefs within ourselves that there's something wrong with me. There must be something wrong with me. That's the only possible explanation for why my mother wouldn't attune to me, for why she gave me the silent treatment, for why she was passive aggressive, for why my father always had us walking around on eggshells, or whatever your story is. The deep core belief is there has to be something wrong with me. There's no other possible explanation for why my parents couldn't give me the love that I needed, unless there's something wrong with me. Complex PTSD can form along adverse childhood experiences, but not always. We usually have a hypervigilance about the environment and the communication cues of people in our environment. And again, that comes from being in the water we were swimming in, right? We had to learn to figure out what everyone's facial expression meant, what everyone's sigh meant. I saw a meme one time that was like, you know, you're not supposed to know whether your parent is in a good mood or a bad mood based on the sound of their footsteps coming down the hallway. Like, that's not normal. You know, like that's a complex PTSD type environment. So because of things like our parents' footsteps coming down the hallway and not knowing if that meant we were in trouble or not in trouble, because of, you know, narcissistic parents who we had to walk on eggshells around or any of these other things, we learned to be very hypervigilant. Like we have a sensitivity about us that a lot of people don't have who don't have complex PTSD. You know, we get labeled like highly sensitive or empathic or something like that. But really, like it's an adaptation to an environment that we were in that we had to survive. Now it can be channeled into a superpower, but it can also like take you down, right? Hypervigilance can make you very anxious. The nervous system state for people with complex PTSD is usually, not always, this is not a generalization, it's usually immobilization, and they're more likely to fawn and people please. When you're in a fight flight state, you're less likely to fawn and people please. It's only when we get into those like shut down, immobilized sort of states that we lose access to the energy that we need to like get the fuck out or assert ourselves. And so then what do? We just roll over and people please, right? And that's how we learned how to get through the water we were swimming in. It's very common with complex PTSD to second guess yourself, doubt yourself, even gaslight yourself. Did it happen that way? Am I sure? Did it really happen like that? Yeah, it probably did. And then it also seems really nebulous. Like if it's like you can't put your finger on that thing that happened that one time, that's like a memory. It's more of like, yeah, it was just this environment that I was always in and I can't point out anything that was like wrong. Or maybe you can, but usually it takes quite a bit of awareness work for people to be like, oh, that's why I do that. Like I had a client that I worked with for 6 months. The first 6 months we worked together, he was like, I don't even know that I really have trauma. Like I really don't know that I do, but he was a hardcore fucking people pleaser. Like could not hold a boundary to save his life. And it took 6 months before we got to the root of why that is. Cause it was like really, really hidden in there. And so he couldn't quite put his finger on what was wrong. It was like very hazy and nebulous, but we got there eventually. Pete Walker says that complex PTSD is a learned set of responses, a failure to complete numerous important developmental tasks. This means that it is environmentally, not genetically caused. CPTSD is neither inborn nor characterological, As such, it is learned. It is not inscribed in your DNA. It is a disorder caused by nurture, or rather lack of it, not nature. What is learned can be unlearned and vice versa. What was not provided by your parents can now be provided by yourself and others. That's from our complex PTSD book. If you haven't gotten it yet, you need to. So common symptoms of complex PTSD, and the ones with the asterisk next to them are also common characteristics of health anxiety. So you will see that there is a ton of overlap, emotional flashbacks, having a tyrannical inner critic, toxic shame, self-abandoning, anxiety, feeling lonely or abandoned, hypervigilance, catastrophization, fragile self-esteem, developmental arrest, relationship difficulties, dissociation, oversensitivity, intolerance to stress, perfectionism, mood swings, negative noticing, control. And I could put an asterisk next to suicidal ideation, because health anxiety was a big reason why I tried to take my own life. Like, just the anxiety of being in it and not knowing how to figure it out, or when it was going to get better, or how I was going to pay for it, or all of that. Like, that was a huge part of it. So I should probably update this slide. It is important, again, this is just a reminder, you guys have heard this before, but I always like to repeat it, to not get attached. Like, we don't have to be attached and hold on to the CPTSD label, like, you know, like we're guarding it with dear life, and we have to put complex PTSD warrior in our Instagram bios and all of that. Like, I don't think that we have to get attached to the label. I think it's important that we remember that this thing that we're dealing with is not genetic. It's learned. That means it can be unlearned. And we have a responsibility to use our agency to become aware of our patterns, behaviors, triggers, and beliefs, and unlearn them to the extent that we can. When I use the term CPTSD, it is not in an attempt to identify with a diagnosis, or to feel like a victim, or to make you identify as a victim. It's just language that succinctly describes a collection of beliefs, nervous system states, emotional states, and behavioral patterns that stem from emotional abandonment and neglect. That's really what it is. It's just way easier to say, I have CPTSD versus I'm hypervigilant about all these communication cues, and I catastrophize about everything, and I do this. And I, like, you see, it's like gets very clunky after a while. So complex PTSD is just way more succinct. It saves time. So complex PTSD is different from post-traumatic stress disorder in two main ways. First, it forms over longer periods of time with prolonged exposure to emotional abandonment or abuse. Again, it's the water you're swimming in. And two, complex PTSD is always relational. That's probably the most distinguishing characteristic of complex PTSD to PTSD. It usually forms in childhood, but not always. It can also form in a long-term intimate relationship. So, like, if you've been married to someone or with someone for, you know, 5 years, 10 years, something like that, and you guys have some dysfunctional patterns in your relationship, it's totally possible that you formed complex PTSD because they've emotionally abandoned you, or because they have verbally abused you, or because they have been narcissistic or something like that. And complex PTSD can form in relationship with ourselves. When we repeatedly self-abandon, we have that little kid on our bus who doesn't trust our higher self to take care of us because we abandoned ourselves in order to avoid getting abandoned. All right, so let's think about our punishing parents. Show of hands, get your little react button ready. So, because I don't want to take too long on each one of these, but let's just get our react button ready. Who had parents who took things away from you when you misbehaved? Toys, food, fun, privileges. Okay. Most of you here. Amazing. All right, clear your reaction buttons. Whose parents isolated you by sending you to your room or locking you in your room? Okay, over half, yep. Whose parents expected perfection, whether that was your grades, your behavior, and you were punished if you made mistakes, meaning you just did normal childhood things and you got punished for it? Okay, most of you, amazing. Any parents who controlled you through punishment or using the threat of punishment to control you? What about parents who made you feel guilty or made you feel ashamed of yourself or told you you were bad? Okay. Anybody have parents who forced you to earn their love back, either through doing like physical labor or emotional labor? Okay. Yeah. Just like let that sink in, like how not alone you are in this. Like really see each other. Like almost everyone in this space right now has experienced very, very similar things. Like that's not small. That's a big deal. Okay, are you ready to have your mind blown? Who takes things away from themselves whenever your body doesn't behave the way it's supposed to? Like you take away food, you take away fun, you won't let yourself rest, you take away pleasure. Who does that? Okay. Yep. Who self-isolates when you're like feeling really bad or, yep. Wow, a lot of you. Okay. Who expects perfection from their body and you punish yourself or your body when your body misbehaves, including if your body gains weight? Anybody attempt to control their body or force it to heal? Yep, wow. Anybody withdraw your own loving presence from yourself when your body is bad? Wow, pretty overwhelming. Who feels shame when you're controlling, forcing, and fixing don't work? Anybody feel guilt for how your health or your anxiety is a burden on others? And who feels guilt if you indulge in something and call it cheating? Okay. Are we seeing the parallels here? Like, I don't think I have to point that out, right? Yeah. Okay. Isn't it amazing how we learn to treat ourselves based on the modeling of our parents? Okay. All right. So perfectionism flashbacks. So if you're triggered by in a perfectionistic state, that looks like all or nothing, black and white thinking. It looks like self-hate and like shame, like, oh, I've done all this and I'm still not better. Right? Oh, I've spent all this money and it's still happening. I've seen all these therapists, I've seen all these doctors and it's still happening. We're micromanaging, we're worrying, we're thought looping, obsessing, projecting into the future. We unfairly compare ourselves or our bodies to others or to a past version of ourselves. Ooh, I'm guilty of that. We have a lot of guilt. We feel guilty for how we feel. We feel guilty if we eat or drink something bad, air quotes around bad. We feel guilty for cheating, right? Like you ate sugar that one time and you're like, oh, I was a bad girl. I cheated. We do a lot of shoulding. I should eat this. I should take that. I should do this. I should fix this. I should. We judge ourselves and our bodies harshly when we're perfectionistic towards our bodies. We drasticize, catastrophize, and blow symptoms out of proportion. We can only seem to focus on the negative, right? We're very good at finding everything that's wrong, and it's very difficult to find something that's right. There's this sense of time urgency, like, oh my God, I better hurry up and get it right or else. Oftentimes perfectionism and procrastination go hand in hand. Like we don't even want to start something if we don't think we can do it perfectly on the first try. There tends to be a victim consciousness in perfectionism. It's kind of like a, why me? Of course this happened to me. Nothing ever goes my way. My body never behaves like I want it to. My body never behaves like other people's bodies. And there's often a belief that you've done something to deserve your symptoms. I do this to this day. I actually pointed it out with David last week. I had a weird symptom come up and it went away in a couple of days. It was no big deal. I don't think it was indicative of anything that was wrong, but my immediate thing was, I wonder what I did to cause this. Like that's always the first thing that comes into my head when I have a new symptom or I get sick or something. It's like, I wonder what I did to cause this. And I caught myself. I caught that voice in my head. And I looked at David and we were in the kitchen. I just remember being like, have you ever noticed how like anytime anything's ever wrong with me, I immediately jump to what I did to cause it? And he was like, isn't that interesting? It happens quite frequently. All right. Let's talk about dissociation for a second. So, what I'm wanting you to see with this is how perfectionism, when it comes to the pattern of perfectionism and it lands on your body, like you're doing all of this about your body, right? Like you're feeling guilty because of how you feel or because of what you eat. You try to micromanage, you obsess over the body, you hate yourself. You feel like you've done something wrong to deserve your symptoms. You have this story in your head that's like, why me? Why does this always happen to me? Why doesn't my body behave like everyone else? Oh, I should do this. I should walk more. I should go outside more often. I should get blue light blockers. I should take this supplement. I should eat keto. I should eat vegan. I should, I should, I should. Like all of that is involved in perfectionism. And we're just applying it to our bodies, right? It's just perfectionism through into our bodies. Like through the lens of the body. All right, now I want to talk about dissociation. So, in the Complex PTSD book, Pete Walker refers to two types of dissociation, left-brained and right-brained dissociation. And we're going to talk about both. So, left-brain dissociation swings between obsessive compulsive doing and then worrying and planning about doing. So, you're kind of like in this constant, like, oh, here's this thing that's wrong. I better fix it. And then I'm fixing it. And then I'm going back to here's this thing that's wrong and I better fix it. So you're kind of a human doing instead of a human being. Left brain dissociation is like constant thinking. So you're always in your head. You're doom Googling to distract yourself from underlying pain or to research and find out more so that you can make a plan for what to do next. You're always trying to stay one step ahead of something. Like, oh, if I could just get this done, then I can rest. If I could just get this done, then I can have fun. If I just do this, if I'm really good with how I eat this week, then on the weekend I'll have a treat, right? Like always focusing on the next thing to stay one step ahead. When severely traumatized, as a flight type, you can develop OCD, so obsessive compulsive disorder. You can be stuck in your head with overanalysis. Left brain dissociators self-medicate with busyness. So they are typically like flight types. Their nervous system is kind of in this state of like trying to run away from the problem. But with health anxiety, the problem, air quotes again, is in the body. So they can't run away from it. So they escape by Googling, right? Seeking certainty, trying to research about their thing, joining the Facebook groups, making multiple doctor's appointments, doing protocols, doing research. Like that's how they're dissociating from the symptom, is by trying to research and fix it. The left brain dissociator is kind of like a chicken with its head cut off. They're just kind of like running around from thing to thing and like it doesn't really make any sense. They rush and they flit about aimlessly as if motion itself is the only important thing. Like as long as I'm doing something, I gotta be constantly doing something. They might even say things to other people. Don't just stand there, do something. Like they always want to be roping other people in to their constant doing. And they typically tend to be high on their own supply of adrenaline. That's left brain dissociation. Pete says extreme flight types are like machines with the switch stuck in the on position. They are obsessively and compulsively driven by the belief that perfection will make them safe and lovable. They rush to achieve. They rush just as much in thought obsession as they do in action compulsion. Left brain dissociation is using constant thinking to distract yourself from underlying abandonment pain. So you're like walking around in your mind, totally detached from your body. So how can we help left brain dissociation? First, always awareness. So when you're engaging in your typical obsessive behaviors, like doom Googling, researching Facebook groups, Instagram searching, doom scrolling, things like that, and your thoughts, you're staying one step ahead, catastrophizing, being stuck in your head, futuristic thinking is coming into awareness about that. Oh, I'm doing the thing again. Oh, I'm Googling again. Oh, there I am, catastrophizing. Like I'm just thinking of all the worst case scenarios that I can think of, like really being in awareness of it. also having a somatic awareness, right? So this kind of awareness is like, oh, I'm doing it again. Like that's a very cognitive process. But somatic awareness is like, okay, I'm doing the thing again, but what am I feeling in my body while I'm doing this thing? What is doom scrolling or doom Googling doing for my body? How do I feel when I'm catastrophizing and thinking of all these worst case scenarios? Like, what am I experiencing in my body to bring yourself totally out of your head and into your body? Always bringing curiosity. So an extreme flight type, a left brain dissociator, curiosity questions for this is like, what hurt am I running from right now? Because even if you're sitting still and you're just on your phone Googling, you're still trying to run from something. Like you're still running away from whatever it is that you're experiencing, and you're trying to find certainty, distraction, answers, whatever in Google. What is the most important priority for me in this moment? Right? Can I stay present in this feeling for a few more moments or minutes? Like that is a huge way to start gently widening the window of tolerance for a flight type, for someone who dissociates through doing. We often think of dissociating as like someone who's just like off in dreamland, or they're like stuck in bed and shut down. But no, you can dissociate and totally be in a flight response. So asking yourself, like, can I be with this uncomfortable feeling? Can I be with this symptom for a few more moments or a few more minutes, instead of grabbing the phone to search or, you know, go on the Facebook groups or seek certainty or whatever. And then finally, what sort of comfort and soothing is my inner child asking for right now? So if it helps, you can picture this anxious kid on your bus who's just constantly doing and trying to be perfect and trying to fix everything and micromanage everything and control everything and figure out all the answers to everything. And like, again, imagining that little part of yourself and like, what kind of comfort do they need? How can you soothe that part of yourself? Because the Googling and the constant doing and being in the flight type and obsessive compulsive stuff is not soothing the inner child, right? Grief work is really, really important. We have to grieve childhood wounds and losses, like our emotionally unavailable parents or a parent who only cared tenderly for you if you were sick. A lot of people with health anxiety only had parents who took care of them when they were sick. It's like their mom couldn't give a shit about them. But if they had a cold, the mom was like, oh, let me make you soup. And here's movies and game shows and orange juice. And like that was, and their mom would cuddle with them and like actually take the day off from work to be with them. But the rest of the time, the mom was like, you know, couldn't really acknowledge their existence. So the health anxiety is a way to get attention, because that's how they received attention as a child. It's fascinating. Grieving looks like self-compassionate crying and even imagined reprocessing with grief. So imagined reprocessing is where you literally play a movie in your mind of like your parent not being available to you, of them abandoning you, neglecting you, and like letting yourself do that important work of grieving over that. And then also this will be very difficult for left brain dissociators, but it's very important to slow down. Your nervous system needs to start becoming familiar with a slower pace, because if you're a left brain dissociator, your nervous system is only familiar with like, oh, I gotta do all the time. I gotta do this all the time. I gotta clean my house and I have to be perfect for my health and I have to work out and I have to go do this and that. And blah, 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 blah. Like that's the left brain dissociator. Okay. This was me my entire decade of my 20s. That was me. Like David can tell you, I was insane, like not clinically insane, but like it was nuts. So slowing down, and you can do this gradually. Like I wouldn't expect anybody to flip a switch on being able to slow down after being in such a frantic pace. But if you can do things like little short meditations, even 60 seconds, 2 minutes, 5 minutes, something like that. If you can find some slow breath work, like slow inhales with an exhale that's longer than the inhale, or box breathing, something like that, or going on really intentionally slow walks. So like, I don't know why, but flight types tend to be like really over exerciser, like runner cardio kind of people. And so if you can go on a slow walk that has nothing to do with burning calories or doing cardio, and it has everything to do with like stopping to smell the flowers and listen to the birds, great way to like slow your nervous system down and start to familiarize your nervous system with that slower pace. Now let's talk about right-brain dissociation. This is typically what we think of when we think of shutdown or collapse. So let's see if you identify with any of these. We weren't allowed to use fight, flight, or fawn responses as kids to get to safety. So we seek refuge in dissociative behaviors like excessive sleeping, watching TV, scrolling, online browsing, video games, and daydreaming. It can also present with symptoms of ADD. We have mastered the art of changing the internal channel when our inner experience becomes uncomfortable. So as soon as we start feeling uncomfortable, we check out of the body, we shut down, we're scrolling, we're sleeping, we're watching TV, whatever else. We can often project perfectionism onto others, and we can use the imperfections of others to justify isolating ourselves. It's like a juicy way to not be around people, to stay dissociated and shut down by being like, oh, I don't like them anyway. I don't want to be around them. Sometimes right brain dissociators can exhibit extreme detachment from reality, especially when they're in a flashback. They may have very few to no positive relationship experiences and be skeptical and scared of intimate relationships. They are less likely to seek therapeutic help. They can be in denial of how their adaptations have narrowed their lives, and they are often self-medicating with alcohol, narcotics, weed, kratom, et cetera. Pete says, it is often the scapegoat or the most profoundly abandoned child, the lost child who is forced to habituate to the freeze response. Now allowed to successfully employ fight, flight, or fawn responses, the freeze type's defenses develop around classical or right brain dissociation. Dissociation allows the freeze type to disconnect from experiencing his abandonment pain and protects him from risky social interactions, any of which might trigger feelings of being re-traumatized. So here's some help for right brain dissociators. Very, very important to have some sort of therapeutic relationship with co-regulation. We have to heal in safe relationship, preferably with a professional who's familiar with this state. Also at home, co-regulation with mammal pets like your cat or your dog can be really, really helpful. Also having awareness of our right brain dissociation, of the childhood wounding, being the scapegoat, the most abandoned child, and of your coping mechanisms, your adaptive patterns like sleeping, gaming, watching TV, isolating yourself, being so stuck you do nothing. Also somatic awareness with this. So it's not just about being in your head, having awareness. It's also, what am I feeling in my body? What does dissociation feel like? What does self-isolation feel like? Maybe it feels numb. Numb is still a sensation. Okay. And then nervous system mobilization. This is an important step because when you're right brain dissociated, you're at the bottom of the polyvagal ladder. And remember, safety is all the way up at the top, and that requires mobilization to go through all of the states on the ladder to get to safe and social at the top. So you're going to definitely want to do this with someone because you need the co-regulation. Co-regulation just basically means that you're borrowing someone else's nervous system when your own doesn't have the resources. And then you can use mobilizing breathwork or other somatic tools. You guys got my Thawing the Freeze Response workshop when you purchased Feel Without Fear. There are two practices in that workshop for mobilization. One is a breathwork practice, one is movement practice. So if you're a right brain dissociator and you're wanting like real ways to mobilize your nervous system in a safe way, definitely check out that workshop if you haven't already. Okay, before we talk about disembodiment, I'm just curious, who would identify as more of a left brain dissociator? Okay, kind of a human doing, or not a human being. Okay, cool. And who would identify as a right brain dissociator? You're more shut down. And you can also do both. Like, you don't have to be one or the other. You can do both. Yeah. Okay. Pretty even split. That's pretty cool. Now we will talk about disembodiment. So whether you are in left brain dissociation or right brain dissociation, you are not embodied when you are dissociated, obviously. And when you have health anxiety, you are not embodied. When you have anxiety of any type, you are not embodied. 100% of the time, a disembodied person is going to have anxiety of some sort. I believe that their anxiety is their body's way of calling them back to their body. because disembodied means you're not connected to the body. When you're hyper-focused on symptoms, you're not connected to your body. You're connected to your thoughts, not your body. So every client with any type of anxiety that I've ever had has always had one thing in common. They hope that by working with me, the troubling sensations and symptoms they experience will be got rid of, fixed, or resolved. And they have the belief that no symptoms equals healed. If I can get to a place of no symptoms, then it means I'm healed. If I can get to a place of, even if your symptom is anxiety or depression or OCD or panic or insomnia, if I can get to a place of no symptoms, then I am healed. But no symptoms doesn't heal health anxiety because it's not about the symptoms. Just like not having a relationship doesn't heal relationship anxiety, right? You could get rid of all of your relationships. And yeah, you may not have relationship anxiety anymore, but the second you get back in a relationship, the relationship anxiety is going to come back. Not having money or having more than enough money doesn't heal money anxiety. And not having friends doesn't heal social anxiety. So you don't have social anxiety because of your friends. You don't have relationship anxiety because of your relationship. And you don't have health anxiety because of your symptoms. You don't have money anxiety because of money. Any kind of anxiety is marked by hypervigilance. So hypervigilance about your environment, other people, people's facial expressions, body language, danger, or your own internal sensations. Any kind of anxiety is marked by hypersensitivity. So lights, sounds, smells, other people, facial expressions, body language, perceptions, or internal sensations. Any kind of anxiety is marked by catastrophizing. So in social anxiety, we catastrophize about belonging, right? Do I fit in here? Do I belong? Do these people like me? What are these people thinking about me? Am I behaving the right way? Right. What others' behavior or what their communication means, or we're catastrophizing about what are these sensations in my body mean? What are these symptoms in my body mean? Oh my God, it must mean I have cancer. Any kind of anxiety is marked by obsessive thinking and worrying. So you're worrying about your environment. You're worrying about other people, facial expressions, body language, danger, internal sensations, attempts to control and micromanage. You want to control your environment. You want to control other people. You want to control situations, or you want to control your own internal experience. And anxiety is marked by perfectionism. So you're perfectionist about your own behavior, about others' behavior, about your work. You project that perfectionism onto other people, and you can be perfectionistic about your own health or your own body. So health anxiety is just like any other kind of anxiety, except health anxiety doesn't involve a relationship with another person, group, or entity, such as money or a business. Health anxiety occurs in relationship to your own body. And often, people with health anxiety are also very anxious, hypervigilant, and controlling of the health of their partner, their kids, or their pets. Anybody with health anxiety want to admit to being anxious or hypervigilant about the health of your partner, your kids, or your pets? Okay. Amazing. Thank you for being honest. I appreciate that so much. Yeah. Okay. I'm talking to the right people. That's exciting. So overcoming health anxiety is not about troubleshooting symptoms. It's not about changing your diet. It's not about a bunch of supplement recommendations or protocols. It's not about learning more health information. It's not about joining different Facebook groups or following more Instagram accounts, and it's not about finding a different health practitioner. I could make the same slide for overcoming relationship anxiety is not about troubleshooting problems in the relationship or perceived problems in the relationship. It's not about leaving your partner or not leaving your partner. It's not about having certainty in the relationship that they're never going to leave you. It's not about having a perfect relationship. If we had social anxiety here, overcoming social anxiety is not about, you know, finding a different friend group. It's not about being perfectionistic around other people in order to be accepted or in order to belong. It's not about getting more information about how to be more comfortable in social situations. Like, it's not about any of that. Overcoming health anxiety is about widening your window of tolerance to hold uncomfortable sensations, reducing reactivity, catastrophization, and hypervigilance through creating safety in your body, overcoming health anxiety is mm-hmm. about changing the energy with which you approach your healthcare, acceptance of whatever is happening, and cultivating self-trust. And the same things could be applied to overcoming relationship anxiety is about widening your window of tolerance to hold uncomfortable sensations and experiences in your relationship. It's about reducing reactivity, catastrophization, and hypervigilance by creating safety in your relationship and in your own body. It's about changing the energy with which you approach your relationship. It's about accepting whatever is happening in your relationship. And it's about cultivating self-trust and trust in the other person. Overcoming social anxiety is about widening your window of tolerance to hold uncomfortable sensations, reducing reactivity, catastrophization, and hypervigilance by creating safety in your own body, changing the energy with which you approach social situations, acceptance of whatever is happening, and cultivating self-trust. Are we seeing the theme? Do we see how this literally applies to any kind of anxiety? Okay, but the biggest question that people always ask with health anxiety specifically is, but what if there's something actually wrong with me? Okay, Linka finds that funny. What if I actually do have thyroid cancer, right? Like, what if I actually do have something wrong with me? Because that can be real. You might actually have something wrong with you. So there's always the possibility that there is something medically, physiologically wrong in your body that may require treatment or intervention of some sort. Feeling sensation and symptoms and noticing the story in your head about them doesn't mean that you can't or shouldn't seek medical care or that medical help isn't necessary. It might be, and that's okay. The point of feeling without fear isn't to fix, get rid of, micromanage, or control sensation or symptoms. We can experience painful symptoms without fear. That may seem impossible for you today, but it is possible, or with lowered levels of fear. I don't want to always say that you have to get to a place of having zero fear, because that's not humanly possible. Feeling without fear changes the energy with which we approach our healthcare, or with which we approach our bodies. So in unconsciousness, we are reacting, we're urgent, we have anxious energy, we're closed off, we resist, we're angry at our bodies. But we can choose to respond instead of react, to slow down instead of having like everything is an emergency all the time, to have peaceful energy instead of anxious energy, to be open instead of closed, to accept and surrender instead of resisting what's happening, and to learn to take care of better care of our bodies instead of being angry at our bodies. So when you're triggered by a health symptom or really anything, the suffering is in the resistance. Resistance is what creates suffering. Avoidance of or panic about feeling equals you're going to keep fighting against your body. You're going to keep trying to micromanage, control, catastrophize, Google, research, fix, all of that. But when you're feeling without fear, you're listening to your body. You're just present with whatever's happening. You're present with the story in your head. You're present with the sensation. You're telling your body, thank you for speaking to me. I trust you. I'm safe, even if this sensation is happening. When we avoid or panic about feeling, we are trying to think and fix our way out of pain or illness or discomfort. But when we're feeling it without fear, we can settle into our bodies and create the best reality that we can by working with our bodies. When we avoid or panic about feeling, we're living in this panicked, anxious resistance, especially if you're the flight type or the left brain dissociator, like I talked about earlier. When you're feeling without fear, you can live in calm acceptance of what's happening, and you can go seek out help if you need to. When we're avoiding or panicking about feeling, we're fighting to get help. We want to get it fixed as soon as possible. We're possibly spending money that we don't have to force the fixing to happen. When we're feeling without fear, we can choose the help that we need with ease and trust that if it's what we need, we won't have to force it or fight for it. Avoidance of and panic about feeling means that panic and forcing our way into the doctor and testing and all of that, like we're always trying to force something to happen. We want the soonest available doctor's appointment. We want the soonest available lab appointment. We want the soonest available whatever. When we're feeling without fear, we can be in kind of a grounded waiting to see if the body resolves the sensation or symptom on its own. And obviously, you will probably know if what you're experiencing is a true emergency. So in 2019, I went to the emergency room and urgent care four separate times with really painful sensations and symptoms in my pelvis. My urethra spasmed for 5 months. Like I had a UTI, except I didn't have a UTI. All four times I went, they tested my urine because I had the symptoms of UTI. I had blood in my urine. I had like pain with my urination, frequent urination, like all the symptoms of a UTI. Every time they test my urine, it would not culture any bacteria whatsoever. Also, my pelvis had this like heavy sensation, like something was going to fall out of me, but I didn't have a prolapse. Like it would hurt when I reached my arms up. It was worse if I was up walking around. It got better if I lied down. I would get very tired. My lower belly would be very, very bloated. So I was having that along with a spasming urethra. And at the same time, I was also experiencing debilitating anxiety and insomnia, panic attacks pretty much every day, if not multiple times a day, no more than 2 or 3 hours of sleep every night for 5 straight months. I mean, I was in rough, rough shape. All of this was happening at the same time. I panicked for 5 months. Obviously, this resulted in a really quick decline in my overall health. The pain and sensations improved when I laid down. So I spent almost all of that 5 months bedridden. Like I was just like, well, if I feel better when I'm laying down, I guess my body just needs rest. So I'm going to give my body rest. And then I ended up being in bed. I lost a ton of weight. I lost a ton of muscle because I wasn't up moving around. And all of the sensations and symptoms that I was experiencing were too fucking much. Like all of this at one time is so much. Excuse me. So not only was I dealing with the pelvic pain and the urethra spasming and symptoms, I had this anxiety and insomnia on top of it. My whole fucking life was researching, calling doctors, going to the ER, going to urgent care, teaching myself to read my own fucking CT scans, joining Facebook groups, researching, trying to fix myself, trying to find the answer, trying to figure out how I was going to pay for it. All of that. It was miserable. I was fighting against and desperately trying to fix my mind and my body, but in this energy, like it was never going to work. You know what I mean? Turns out that going to the ER and urgent care all four times was totally unnecessary because what was wrong with me was never going to be solved in the ER. It was not an actual emergency. It seemed like an emergency because the story in my head was that something was terribly wrong with me and no one could figure it out. So I forced and pushed and resisted trying to find answers. But I had pelvic congestion syndrome, which is varicose veins in the pelvis that required a little surgery, which I had in June of 2019. That was not something that's going to be solved in the emergency room. I had pelvic floor dysfunction and needed physical therapy. Also not something that was going to get solved in the emergency room. And the anxiety and the insomnia were not something that were going to be solved in the emergency room, but that was my way of like, I have to have something right now. I have to have someone to talk to. I need a professional. I need labs. I need testing. I need a doctor right now, because the story in my head about all I was experiencing was that, oh my God, I am dying. It is an emergency. None of this were emergencies though. The health anxiety told me they were. So in hindsight, I have a lot of compassion for myself at that time. I did not have any awareness at that point. I had not woken up yet. I did not know how to exist in my body with acceptance, openness, love, support. I understand now that my 10-year obsession prior with health and wellness prior to this experience is partly responsible for my resistance to feeling and fear of sensation and symptoms. I had been in health and wellness world for a decade, and in health and wellness world, symptoms are supposed to be suppressed and fixed too. There is a little bit more emphasis on root cause, but symptoms and sensations that are uncomfortable are looked at in a very similar way to mainstream medicine. It's just that instead of using pharmaceuticals to manage the body, you're using supplements and restrictive healing diets and things like that. But it's still a very similar mindset. I'm also now able to see how I was seeking certainty and answers from sources outside of myself at that time, whether that be Google, Facebook group, doctors, emergency room, whatever. If you think about it, when a kid is afraid, she looks to authority figures for safety, right? She looks to parents, teachers, grandparents, police, firefighters, et cetera. And that's healthy because she's not capable of providing for her needs emotionally, physically, or relationally. Like developmentally, she's just not capable. So she looks at authority figures for help, for answers, for safety. The child develops self-trust when she has emotionally available parents who encourage her to listen to her own body and intuition, who don't catastrophize about her normal childhood sicknesses or normal curiosities in play, such as climbing trees or jumping off a higher surface. She also develops self-trust when she's allowed to learn through mistakes or trial and error. When she has questions to the parents or the authorities, she's met with openness and love rather than shaming. And she develops self-trust as a natural response to being raised in an environment where her childish behaviors, curiosities, and questions are met with love, compassion, empathy, and safety. Self-trust is our natural state. Like, your natural state of existence is to trust yourself. If you don't trust yourself, like, it's just something to be aware of and something to start cultivating. But your natural state is self-trust. Full-grown adults with unhealed inner child parts outsource their self-trust. And in the absence of the self to take care of us, we look to outside authority figures for answers, just like we did as kids. So instead of going to the police or the firefighters or the parents or the grandparents, as adults, where do we go? We go to Google. We go to Facebook groups. We go to Instagram accounts. We go to health websites. We go to doctors. It's just insecure attachment playing out with your own body, right? In the absence of self-trust, you don't have that secure attachment with yourself. So both wellness culture and conventional medicine pathologize symptoms. When they pathologize symptoms, that means they're also pathologizing sensation, because symptoms are sensations. When our sensations and symptoms are pathologized, it leads to us pathologizing sensation and being fearful of feeling and disconnecting from our bodies. So am I saying that if you learn to feel without fear, then the sensations will subside and the symptoms will go away? Is that what I'm saying? No. No, I'm sorry. I'm not. I can totally understand that you desperately want certainty. You want certainty that this is the answer, that she's going to have the answer. Anytime now, there's going to be a slide that has the answer on it. Certainty that whatever you're feeling, or that feeling sensation, will make the sensations disappear, right? Okay, if I just learn how to feel my feelings, then it's going to go away, right? You want certainty that you won't have to feel uncomfortable things in your body again. If I can just get over this one thing, I won't have to feel it again. You want certainty that you're going to have your health back, which is understandable. And you want certainty that you won't ever be triggered again. Also understandable. Not realistic, but understandable. The certainty that you seek does not exist. This is such a hard thing for people with anxiety to hear. So if this feels really tender for you, like, I see you, I know, I am you. I'm a certainty seeking addict as well in recovery, but the certainty that we want, the answers we want, it doesn't exist. Like, it's a myth. It's not real. The truth is that we are going to get triggered again, that you're not going to always have perfect health. Like, that's true. The truth is that your symptoms may not go away at all. The truth is that you may still have a condition for which you need medical help. The truth is that you will never stop feeling uncomfortable things as long as you are alive in a human body. And the truth is that I don't have the answer. There isn't one answer, and no one has the answer. Like, that's the truth. And if that's hard for you to hear, I totally understand if that feels tender. If you have been seeking certainty, you may need to grieve over the fact that you have been searching for a mythical creature. It is okay if you feel sad, mad, hopeless, helpless, weak, exhausted, and upset that the certainty that you're seeking doesn't exist. And trust me, you're going to go, if you're a certainty seeker, you're not going to just like stop seeking it tonight. Like, it's you're going to keep doing it because it's a pattern that you have to interrupt. But as I'm saying this, the certainty that you want doesn't exist. Even if it's not about your body, maybe it's about your relationship. Maybe you just want to be certain that they're not going to leave you, or certain that you're meant to be together. Or maybe you want certainty with, you know, I just want certainty that my kids aren't going to have the same trauma that I have. I want certainty that the way that I'm mothering my kids isn't going to fuck them up. Maybe you want certainty about, you know, money and being able to pay your bills. Maybe you want certainty that the next time you go out with your friends, that you're not going to feel like a total jackass when you get home because you probably said something stupid and everybody's talking about you. Like, whatever the anxiety is, you want certainty. So if you notice that I'm telling you that there is no certainty, do you notice any sensations in your body as you like digest that reality that that's not real? maybe you notice resistance. Maybe you're like, no. No, somebody has it. Like, it's out there somewhere. Maybe you don't have it, but it's out there. Or maybe you're feeling just like really disappointed. Like, oh, fuck. Maybe you're feeling like, God, I've wasted so much time looking for something that doesn't exist. Maybe you feel mad about it. Whatever you're feeling is okay. Just notice. So if certainty doesn't exist, what is the point? If you can't be certain of what you want to feel so certain about, then what? Right? If you can't know that you know that you know something, then what? Trust. This is where trust comes in. Your natural state is to trust yourself. The opposite of uncertainty is not certainty. The opposite of uncertainty is trust. I trust that I can feel the sensations of my body and be okay. I trust that feelings and sensations aren't harmful. They're just how my body speaks and lets me know something isn't okay. I trust that I can face triggers and be okay. I trust myself to know if I'll need medical care. I trust that the resources I need will be available when I need them. I trust in my body's ability to heal when I give my body what it needs. I trust myself to feel uncomfortable things. Let's take a quick break. Let's come back at, we'll say 36 after the hour. That gives us 5 full minutes.